Welcome to the MWOD Hangouts, an audio project of MobilityWOD.com. I'm Dr. Kelly Starrett, co-founder of MobilityWOD and author of Becoming a Supple Leopard, Ready to Run and Deskbound. I'm a coach, physical therapist, an athlete, a rider, and an innovator who works with Olympic gold medalists, professional athletes, CEOs, military forces, as well as everyday people who just want to be healthier and happier in their lives. What I've learned is that we live in a world of extraordinary human physical achievement. More people today are fitter, stronger, faster, and pushing their physical limits than any other time in history. But we are all too often still bewildered by many of the most fundamental questions relating to our physicality. Over the past few years, I've been exploring these questions in interviews with athletes, scientists, and authors as part of a video series we called MWOD Hangouts. Today, we're proud to be releasing some of the most engaging MWOD Hangouts as free audio content, available for download at mobilitywod.com/podcasts. If you enjoy what you hear and like to access even more content like it, check us out at mobilitywod.com. That's WOD.com, where we've assembled the world's most comprehensive database of guided movement, mechanics, and mobility videos, all aiming at improving performance and eliminating pain. Each motivated by a simple idea that all human beings should be able to perform basic maintenance on themselves. Until then, thank you for listening and enjoy. Hey, we're back to the MWOD Hangouts. Every guest is special. I mean, every guest is a unique snowflake. But today we have maybe the toughest, most badass snowflake I have ever met of all time. With us is, I don't know, I can't even have world champions that you count on one hand. That's all passe. We're into world championships that you count on two hands. And, dude, we're hanging out with Rebecca Rush, four-time winner of the world's longest and gnarliest bike race, the Leadville 100, world champion in whitewater paddling, adventure racing, I think world champion in endurance biking, and teammate to Juliet. We're just going to break the third wall there. But and as a testament to how tough these girls are, Rebecca calls Juliet meat. That's all you need to know about. Right, so we are on. Let me introduce Rebecca Rush, the one and the only. She's been a friend of ours for I mean, well over a decade, almost 15 years now we've been hanging out and knowing each other. I've had the good luck of running some of her adventure races, my LC2 partner race with her. We've been following her around the globe, watching her exploits, and as a testament that it is possible to get better and better and better with age, I think by the time you're 100, you're going to be the greatest athlete on the planet. Thank you so much for talking to us on the MWOD. It's amazing to have you. Thank you.
It's awesome to be here. And I knew you before you were like Kelly Starrett, like the big man on campus. It's awesome to talk to you.
Well, you know, pretty fun to – so for those of you guys, of course you don't know the background, but I was in Chile jogging before the World Championships, running with my friend Ryan, and I ran past this girl who had glutes and biceps, and she was tough. And I remember thinking, these women on the American team are pretty badass. And I will just say that this was before I had physically met Juliet. So on the team, right, you're racing with Juliet. And, you know, I really got a chance to see you and know you firsthand for a week at the World Championships racing. And then after that, man, we touched each other's lives in a million different points. And it's watching you just ascend, you know, ascendancy is, it's pretty amazing. And, you know, you have a brand new book out. It's sort of someone finally goaded you to kind of talk about your incredible life and really sort of put out there, you know, the story of how incredible it is. Do you have a copy of the book? I'm at the gym. I've left my copy at home. Do you have a copy right there? I know you do.
Yeah, there is one sitting here. Yeah, there it is.
Dude, rush to glory. And I'll tell you straight up that you really, if you're interested in sort of tracking how someone gets from point A to point B and redefines themselves and reapplies a set of skills over and over again, plus sort of a roadmap for work ethic and also perseverance. I mean, you know, I think you're the first person to say that you did not think all of this was preordained, even though you've been an athlete your whole life.
Yeah, I have been an athlete my whole life, but I have to say, you know, probably I wouldn't say super genetically gifted. You know, I suffer from asthma and some breathing issues, and the key to all of it has been, like you said, is just trying really hard. Everyone sort of wants this magic pill, or, you know, there's people who are very gifted, but they don't work that hard. There's kind of no secret except for working hard and doing things that you really love to do. It makes the hard work easier.
We just put up something on Twitter about these greyhounds, which is kind of a perfect analogy, because you are really like the ladiest greyhound of all time in terms of your ability to go. But what's interesting is that when these greyhounds train, they train them formally only a couple days a week, but a lot of the training looks like play, and they run two dogs up and down against the fence. And the trainer's like, yeah, the reason these dogs are so good is they have fun, and there's this element of joy in their training. And I have to say that around you, it's interesting that, you know, you've always been an athlete, you've always been a runner, you've always been, you know, like engaged in sort of personal experience in terms of big wall climbing and adventure racing, but you have always loved to train, even though maybe the competition days, oh, you always have the dread and all that, but like, the training piece is pretty miraculous around it. I mean, you love to train, true fact?
I love to play, and I think that greyhound analogy is really good. And when I started riding a bicycle as an adult, like, I didn't start racing mountain bikes till age 38, and it kind of occurred to me, is like, we ride bikes as kids and we play and we're having fun and, you know, pulling our feet off the pedals and having a great time. Why do we lose that as adults? Why do we suddenly look at our workouts as, oh, I have to go to the gym, or I have to do this many crunches, or I have to do this? And so I've been always about, and the people that I work with or teach now is, you know, find something that feels like play, because then you'll do it. And all of the extra health benefits that come along with it are the things you're striving for, but they're happening without you having to really try. So if you find something like rock climbing or paddling or biking that's fun for you, then all of a sudden it's not work. And I think that's really key in the stuff that you do. And it's why I've had a long career as an athlete, because I've done a lot of different sports. And if I get bored with one, I try another one. And I think that's kind of the holy grail of longevity as an athlete and having a good time.
Well, it's one of the things that we see in the gym is that people lose track of why we're in the gym in the first place. That the gym there is immense satisfaction in training and the PRs that come along with it and the community that goes with it, but really the reapplication of trying to go back out and take those skills and challenge them. And one of the things that we are always in a conversation and dialogue about is, you know, what sports do I want my children to play? What sports make them really competent adult athletes? Because at some point, I mean, we'll get to your amazing story in a second, but at some point, you know, you can't play football anymore. There's some sports that we do that where the edge sort of comes off a little bit in terms of our need to huck off gigantic cliffs and things. And, you know, you said, you know, hey, I didn't really pick up a bike till age 38. Well, that's sort of a true statement and sort of not a true statement in terms of, you had been an aerobic athlete and a complex mover around the paddling or the rock climbing, but you had been and trained as having an aerobic base literally your whole life. I mean, from as early as, I mean, you were like, a high school runner and a college runner. I mean, so it's interesting that you say, hey, I didn't really pick up the bike till 38. But yet you had enough play, sport background that had developed considerable aerobic base that you were able to sort of leverage that and then also just happened to also find great success at. I mean, it's amazing how long you've been playing and the amount of put into the bank that you've been able to leverage. I mean, I don't think people can appreciate how much effort and time has gone into developing that considerable engine.
Yeah, well, I would say that, you know, being a runner as a kid, that definitely, you know, strengthened joints and ligaments and things that take a long time for an endurance athlete to develop. And so, you know, playing as a kid, whether it's playing kick the can around with the neighborhood kids or playing tag in the neighborhood, all those sort of strength running around as a kid, playing soccer, I think developing an endurance sport as a young kid is really important, whether it's a bicycle or running. And then I think the other thing that allowed me to jump into a lot of different sports, like you said, and have the strength to do it, was that I also took up some strength sports like paddling and rock climbing. And so not only was I, you know, building my heart and, you know, my muscles and those things, but I was getting the upper body and the core strength to sort of be a more complete athlete. And I think it did help me jump from, you know, kayaking to running to skiing to now to mountain biking.
Amazing. One of the things, I think we're about the same age. How old are you now, Rebecca?
46.
46. So we basically went to high school together. You were the senior that I had a crush on. You know, can you talk a little bit, because we just talked to Levi Leipheimer, who was also just happened to be another Leadville 100 winner, you know, guy. And he was saying that, you know, we're seeing that the athletes, endurance athletes are, and males are really peaking in their sort of mid 30s, 32 to 35. It takes that long to become such a big, competent aerobic machine. You were clearly, I mean, racing Molokai, your endurance and capacity to suffer from solo big wall climbs to your incredible and storied career as one of the premier women in adventure racing on the planet for a decade. I mean, you know, that's, but it's amazing to see you at age 38, then pick up a new sport and then literally dominate the field for the last, you know, 6, 7, 8 years. I mean, can you talk a little bit about what that feels like to, I mean, are there differences at age 38 than 28? And like, what are the, cause a lot of us who are listening, you know, we appreciate that you're still out, you know, blowing doors. And I am like, holy crap, how does she do it? Can you talk about that a little bit?
You know, I think what we're seeing that's really cool, we're seeing athletes like Dara Torres, or we're seeing plenty of athletes in their 40s who are even still going to the Olympics and be very competitive. And I think it's one, I think we've all gotten smarter, you know, like books like yours or people like you that are educating us on the things that I've learned. Basically, is I've learned how to train better. I train less hours and more efficiently with a coach and things that I never used before, like power training on the bicycle. But I've also learned how to rest. And that's something that I think as a 20-something athlete, we always think more is better. You know, if I can work this hard, well, then if I work a little bit harder, it'll be better. And so I think as a whole, athletes have gotten smarter with the technology, with the equipment, and with the science behind it. We're all smarter, and we know how to train better, and people are learning the importance of recovery. And so that's allowed me to basically race people, you know, in their 20s and to put out better and better numbers, even though I'm in my 40s that, you know, that I didn't have before. And it's sort of like, I wish I knew this stuff when I was younger, but I also think the advantage that we have, you know, as more mature athletes is we have the brain power to know that you can ride 100 miles or there's, you know, your most powerful asset is between your ears. And so, you don't know that stuff when you're younger, but now that I'm 46, I know I can ride the Leadville 100. I can probably do it in this amount of time, you know, give or take. And there's a lot of just a lot of strength and power in just having the knowledge and the experience.
That's amazing. There's so much in there, but can you drill down a little bit on what are some of your practices? Like, I know you're a firefighter and you're a full-time professional athlete and, you know, and a cyclist. What are some of the nitty-gritties? Like, what, like, this changed and life got better? Can you talk some specifics for those of us who are listening?
Well, with the bike racing, for specifics, is I got a coach. You know, I hadn't really had a coach since high school running, and I was doing a lot of sports and just, you know, having a great time and having great success, but without a lot of direction. And so when I started bike racing, because I wasn't a bike racer and I was lousy at riding a bicycle, I actually enlisted some help. And so I got a coach, and there's nothing like having a professional give you guidelines of, okay, you know, I did specific one-legged pedal stroke drills. I started using a power meter on the bicycle. And what's really amazing about a power meter, it's like squatting in the gym. You know, it measures exactly how much power you're putting into the pedal, and it doesn't lie. And I've trained for years with heart rate training, and probably everyone listening to this knows that your heart rate can fluctuate based on being sick or stressed or hydration, but the power numbers don't lie. And so it was really cool for me to start training with power on the bike. And that's what made the big difference for me to be able to see, yes, today is a good workout day, or, you know, it's time to call the intervals off. I'm not recovering. And it was very direct numerical feedback instead of me going, I don't feel good, but I'm just going to keep pushing harder. And so having those concrete numbers and getting more educated in that way and going and doing those tests every year and using the power meter every week, I could really see what my legs were actually doing and what was working and what wasn't working. And I think those kind of measuring tools are really important for athletes.
We, you know, clearly we say it's observable, measurable, repeatable phenomenon. Like that is just one of our mantras that, you know, if you can't see change, you need to make change.
Yeah.
You know, being able to see it in real time, have you felt, because for those people who don't know, I mean, like, Eco Challenge, Raid Galois, like 24-hour mountain, like you can suffer like I've never met a human being can suffer. Like you can downshift and just grind on. And I mean, there's some story in my head, I think, maybe I imagined it, where you came back from Borneo and you pooped a like 2-foot worm. I mean, like you literally are the queen of like, you can suffer. Have you been able, because what I'm saying is that I know that you can override, like all the type A athletes, I know you can override how you feel and get some work done. Have you been able to correlate desire to train now, and have you been able to listen in on the body and make sense of the power meter, or do you feel like we really need to keep having these objective measures because my internal compass and clock is so off from the reality because you can override it? Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I would say the answer is yes and no. When I race, for example, I have the power meter running, so I'm recording that data, but I don't look at that. I race just by heart and soul and how I feel, because I know athletes who also get married to those numbers and they're looking at it during a race. They're going, oh no, I can't go any harder. This is my maximum power, and you never know. They may have reached another level and outsprinted their competitor. And so it can work both ways. The power meter can limit you, the numbers can limit you, or they can open doors for you. And so when I race, I turn that stuff off. I'm not looking at it. I'm just recording it. But in the day-to-day workouts, absolutely I'm using it, because I find a lot of times where I think I might be having a bad day, and I'll look down and go, oh, actually, I'm not really having a bad day. So we aren't. I'm a pretty intuitive athlete, I think, after being an athlete this long. But there are definitely days where I get out there, and I think all of us feel it. The first 20 minutes, you're like, I feel crappy. This sucks. I should get another job. What am I doing? And then sure enough, you know, you warm up into it, and things get a little better. And so sometimes you do need that number reinforcement to be like, all right, Rebecca, you're okay. You know, things are going to be fine. Just warm up a little bit. So I think it's both. I think it's a really useful tool. It's not essential. Obviously, I was a successful athlete training without power and some of those numbers for a really long time. But it's just another tool in the shed. But absolutely, I don't think people should be staring down at their little computer and not actually enjoying the run or the scenery outside while they're looking around, because there's nothing more motivating than trying to sprint to the next tree or having a competitor next to you who's pushing you harder. And so I think sometimes those are, you know, having groups or having those kind of motivations are more powerful than a specific piece of technology. But I think they both go hand in hand.
Let me ask you this. You have literally had, I mean, since I've known you in 2000 and started for you before then in terms of venture racing, I think maybe like 97, 98, but literally, and before that, you had big goals about rock climbing, these big free solos on some of the big walls. You've had big races and big events like literally every year of your life for the last two decades that I can think of just off the top of my head. Do you burn out, or do you need something like that to just sort of keep you, you know, a deadline keeps you honest? I mean, can you talk about that? I mean, you literally are maybe the least burned out athlete I have ever met. And I know that obviously, you know, it doesn't amortize. It doesn't look like that. There are some highs and lows when you're, you know, sleeping in your Bronco in Utah. But, you know, it's pretty amazing. If I know you here, I meet you in 2000 and I see you here, it looks like you've just never stopped. I mean, can you talk about sort of just the need to continue to race, or do you feel burned out, and how do you manage kind of workload now in life?
Well, I'll tell you a secret. I mean, people think you can see that on paper, and people think, oh, Rebecca's, you know, constantly motivated. And they probably think the same about you. You come across, you know, they see your persona of like, okay, you've got these achievements. You're always motivated. You're always psyched. And, you know, it's not really, it's a dirty little secret, I guess, that even professional athletes get unmotivated and, you know, lack of desire and feel like a fat slob. You know, it happens to all of us. It's happened to me right now because I'm sick. And so absolutely, I get burnt out. And the reason I do sign up for so many adventures and events like, you know, I just went and rode in Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia, because to me, I need the day-to-day training can be a little bit boring. And so I need an adventure out on the horizon to actually keep me honest, something to look forward to and go, okay, yeah, I'm going to do that extra interval session that hurts and makes me want to throw up, but I'm going to do it because I have this really cool trip on the horizon, or because I have some teammates who, you know, want to race Molokai with me in the fall. And so it does keep me honest to sign up for events. But the key to that is I need to sign up for things that are have variety, that are fun, that are places I want to travel. I mean, really, I've used my career as a way to travel the world and see the globe. And it happens to be now from the seat of a bicycle, but it's because I love to explore and my body happens to be the tool that I'm using to do it. And so being able to stay healthy, that's what's motivating for me. That's why I want to go do workouts during the week where I maybe don't want to get up early. It's because I want to keep being able to explore and go see what's around the next corner.
I love that. You know, we say to, you know, musicians, our musician friends, they actually go play open mic. They have to perform. Otherwise, it's just practice, which is fine. But there's some experience in the consummation of the idea that, you know, I tell people all the time, even in our local gym, which is Mom's Dance, I'm like, go sign up for 5K. Go have it hang over your head. Yeah. Go do one of these Spartan races. Go find out about, you know, because the talk of bulls is not the same thing as being in the bull ring. And I think I love this idea that you have hung out, you know, a concept or an idea, and then that really just gives you a tack or a waypoint, you know, on the way to there. So it really does sort of keep the whole thing in context. Otherwise, it just feels like, well, I'm training and maybe I won't get heart disease now and I'm slower than I was, you know, 4 years ago. It really does make a difference. And, you know, I can even speak to the fact that, you know, training for the Molokai now, you know, my race is in 2 months and hangs over my head and I'm thinking critically. And also it makes me really make sure that I'm getting enough sleep and I'm eating enough often enough and drinking enough often enough so that when I put it out, it actually works versus sort of being lazy on some of the details, you know, because if you're just exercising the day, you're like, well, I rode for 3 hours and I ate 3 hours later. It doesn't really matter, you know, but really does matter if there's something sort of a goal towards. I think that's really a big idea.
Absolutely. No, it's super important. And none of us are saving the world by signing up for these events, and most of us won't win, and it doesn't really matter. But, you know, if you stand at the finish line of a 5K or a paddling race or anything, you'll see all those people and they all have smiles on their face. Almost everybody is happy that they signed up. You know, the start line, everybody's got the nervous frown and they're not so excited. But if you stand at the finish line, you're going to see everybody's happy, everybody's excited because they put themselves out there a little bit more than they would. And they're hanging out with their peers. They're hanging out with a bunch of other people who are doing the same crazy stuff. And there's an energy in that, and it's a worthwhile way to spend your weekend. Absolutely.
Do you still get nervous and have dread before events? Do you still be like, why am I doing this? This is terrible. It's going to hurt so much. Do you still get that feeling?
Every time.
You know, that's a real commonality. George St. Pierre, the fighter, is a friend of ours. And he was telling me that, you know, he's like, every time, Kelly, I have a race, I'm like, this is so stupid. Why am I doing this? I'm going to be the worst. I'll embarrass myself. And then he comes through the fight and he's like, I'm so glad I did that. I'm back. You know, I can't wait to do the next one. And I know it's maybe you just have to blind yourself a little bit to it each time, you know?
I think humans, I don't know, we're very forgetful and we need to keep learning the same lesson over and over again and keep, that's why I keep lining up is to keep, because I push myself and I like the person I am at the end, at the finish line. I like who that person is. And so I put up with the start line, nerves and all that and all hard work, because the person who's at the finish line is somebody that I like better. And that's the person I want to strive to be.
Dude, I just got the chills. That is so awesome. That is like literally, I'm going to quote Rebecca Rust forever. We were talking with Stephen Kotler, who, you know, writes a lot about flow and peak flow state. And clearly you are a flow junkie. I mean, when you race, I have seen you go from one of my main homies, we're hanging out, and you literally just switch in. And you're not unpleasant at all. You're just like, click, I can. You put the blinders on. You get done, you're neglecting the fact that you're limping or the race isn't going, and you're just like, and you're still experiencing it. You don't become a robot. But you know, do you feel like after the race? Like, what, how do you come down from that peak experience? And do you feel like you have a little bit of depression, or what do you do to recover, or how long between? Do you have a magic number about that?
Yeah, I mean, the events I do, and, you know, anything where you really put your heart and soul into it, you know, there's adrenaline flowing, you've worked really hard for something, you know, maybe you've worked all year for this one event, and you've blood, sweat, and tears, you put it on the line, and you've had this really powerful experience. And then when it's over, there's often a feeling of letdown, of, you know, I'm kind of going through it right now after that big trip. You know, I was gone an entire month off the grid, no cell phone, riding my bicycle. And yeah, you come home and you're sort of like, wow, what do I do now? And it happened to me after big adventure races as well, or big wall climbs, because you really set your goal, your sights on something. And when you achieve that goal, then you're like, oh, well, what's next? And that's maybe why I keep setting more goals, because it is important for me to have something to work towards. But the main things that I've really learned that I need to do when I come back from a big event or something big like that is, one is to forgive myself a little bit and go, okay, you know, I haven't done any training for a week because I've been sick and I've been at home and I've just been walking the dog, and it's okay. And my coach checks in with me. He's like, are you better yet? Nope. And so it's forgiveness of, okay, I'm not going to train until I'm better. I'm going to let myself recover from this experience. And then when my body and my mind feels ready, and that's where I usually know, if I start going, oh, what should I do today? But if I'm getting up going, no, I don't want to do anything, I think it's important to listen to yourself for that and take a break, because it is, life is sort of ebbs and flows. And, you know, you, after a really big high, you're going to expect a low, and you just have to come back slowly. And then the way that I really rebound is, I got to call up some buddies and be like, hey, who wants to go on a bike ride? Who wants to go on a dog walk? Who wants to go on a paddle? And I need to get my friends involved. When I don't have the motivation myself, I have to get my friends involved, or go to the gym, or go to a class where there's other people around. And that'll pretty instantly get me out of my little hole.
Well, I can see why people would want to walk a dog with you, because they could actually hang with you. But going for a bike ride with you, one of our coaches at the gym was talking about trying to stay on your wheel once at like a local 50 miler. And he was like, what the hell? What the hell, man? You know, and I was like, dude, you met Rebecca Rush the hard way, seeing the back of her wheel go away from you. You know, you just brought up interesting about sort of the need to have training partners. You know, Juliet, you know, is the greatest training partner I've ever had. She's always up for it. You know, she never gets moody. Things don't go well. She just is like, I'll come back tomorrow. Like, she's like literally the greatest training partner I've had in all of these years. But it's important, because we actually do a lot of our training together. We ride bikes, we paddle, we can even paddle the C2 together, and we don't bicker. It's not even divorce, but but you made a really interesting switch. I mean, you were sort of, you know, outrigger racer, which is amazing, and big wall climber, and you climbed with a team, and you usually had some climbing friends, a lot of solos, and then you went right into some big time adventure racing. When that blew up, you know, you were like, you and like Robin Benincasa are like the two most famous like women badasses I ever met. And in reading like Mark Burnett's comments about you and your professionalism and your, you know, and your dedication, what was it like to transition from a real team sport into a really solo experience? Was that a different, were you, did that freak you out at all? Or is this no big deal, because it's more, it just feels like racing?
You know, it was good and bad. In some ways, I really miss, you know, you go to the finish line of an adventure race and you have three other people there who know exactly what you've gone through, and you basically are bonded by that experience. You couldn't come home and explain it to anybody else. And so, you know, sharing the highs and lows and high-fiving with a team, that's really, really special. But on the same hand, there were plenty of adventure races where we were DNF or, you know, an injured teammate. We had to basically drop out, not because of a fault of my own, but because one of my teammates couldn't hang or something happened. And so it's really hard to take a failure as a teammate when it wasn't you necessarily the one who failed. And you know that from paddling as well. Somebody can mess up and you're just like, all right, we're in this together. So you share the highs and you share the lows. And so part of the, you know, racing, so I went from adventure racing to 24-hour solo mountain bike racing. And so you ride in circles on a course, maybe a 20-mile course, for 24 hours and you go around in the circle as many times as you can. And so you are really alone, kind of a hamster on a wheel, just in your own head for 24 hours. And I kind of liked that for a while because I went from such a team sport into going, okay, if I fail or if I win, it's 100% on me. I'm not going to let anybody down and I'm not going to have to worry about anybody, because there were definitely times adventurously too. I was the only female on the team. And so there was a lot of insecurity of, am I going to be the weak link? You know, and I'm racing with big, strong, manly men. And, you know, we all had our strengths and weaknesses, but you definitely go to every race going, oh, I hope I'm not the one to be the weak link. And so the solo stuff was actually really, it was a really nice break for a while. But then I also miss, you know, I kind of miss the team aspect of it. And the bike racing now, what's really fun is they have a lot of events too where you can, they're, you know, you can do them duo teammates. And I've raced with my husband, Greg, a bunch, and some other girlfriends. And so you kind of can get the best of both worlds, the team or the solo aspect with cycling. But, you know, for me as an athlete, I do a lot of training alone, but I also really need to, and I like that. I like being in my own head, but I also really need to have training partners and teammates so that I can mix it up sometimes and kind of, and not just be in my own head and have some, just have somebody to joke with. And like you said, somebody to motivate you. So I think it's good if people are, at least for me, I need to do both. I need to have a little bit of both.
There's legendary mountain biker, Julie Furtado is a friend of ours, right? And she, when she rides with friends, she brings a crossword puzzle because she just dusts everyone on the climbs and gets to the top. And she loves the crossword puzzle. And it's not a big deal. Do you have hard time finding people who can literally ride with you?
No, not at all. I live in Sun Valley, Idaho, and, you know, there's Olympians around every corner, and there's so many fit people. And I also will say it's, you know, people think, oh, you know, you're a pro athlete, so you're going to race. You're going to go fast every, you know, every workout. And that's just absolutely not true. So I do a lot of long, slow days, and those are really fun social rides for me where friends will, you know, they're just chatting, and those are prescribed. I'm supposed to go slowly. And then there's other interval days where if I'm doing hill intervals, I have friends who want to go with me, and they don't have to be my speed, but we all start out together and get warmed up together. It's the same as being in a gym. Somebody might slap on some different weights, but you can still start the process together and motivate each other to get out the door. So it's super easy to find people to ride with. And my husband, Greg's actually really, like, you know, you with Juliet, he's a better cyclist than I am. So he's a really good training partner for me.
Too bad you always point out that he's not a world champion. You know,
he is, actually.
Oh, he is. Oh, man, I knew he was. I'm just kidding. The, what's funny, of course, is that, you know, Juliet is always putting that in my face. She's like, there's only one world champion in this family, and it's not you. I'm like, I'm surrounded by world champions, and you're just part of the entourage of world champions. Let me ask you this. Practices change as you get smarter and older because they have to, and it's best practice. What does your warm-up look like? Do you spend a lot of time warming up? How long does that look like? Because, you know, I mean, Levi talked about, you know, hey, you just get out there sometimes, and it takes a long time to make sure you've touched those aerobic zones, had enough time to really let the system come up on board before you redline it. Mm-hmm. Most people who are compressed really miss that because maybe they're forced to, or they're not realizing it's so important. Can you talk about that for a second?
Yeah, for me, and this is something my coach really has taught me, if I'm going to do a hard interval training session, a proper warm-up takes me 35 to 45 minutes, or a pre-race warm-up takes 45 minutes for a long endurance race. And even if I'm going to do an hour and a half mountain bike race, I'm going to warm up for 45 minutes because it takes me that long. You know, one, I've always been a diesel engine, and so I need to get things firing. But just the physiology of it, you know, it's 20 minutes of easy. And then, yeah, I do work through all the heart rate zones, and you do some sprints and some leg openers. And you really, I mean, do have to sort of open the pipes up if you want to be right out of the gate going hard. It takes the body a while to warm up. If I'm just doing a longer workout, you know, I'll take the first hour, really, of a longer ride to just sort of take it easy on myself, the first couple hills. But a really structured warm-up would be 45 minutes of very specific, you know, 2 minutes at this zone, 1 minute easy, 2 minutes at the next zone, 1 minute easy, and so forth.
I can't even relate to that. I mean, Shane and I, who obviously is one of your teammates, my C2 partner, and we were like, no hard strokes for 5 minutes. Totally, that's all it takes is no hard strokes for 5 minutes. That was our, and no wonder we were so unsuccessful. It was great. My hand went numb. It was awesome. In the adventure racing world, you had a chance to like go out and back and crash and burn and come back and you guys had transcendent experiences where you're like, oh, and I picked up some dengue on the way home. And are these bike races long enough for you to have that experience? Because Leadville is a sprint. That's only like a 6.5-7 hour sprint, right? And is 24 hours, yeah, that's all. Is 24 hours even long enough for you still to go so far out there? Or are you finding that it just feels like a bunch of grinding?
It's different. I mean, yeah, Leadville is 100 miles. So for me, technically that was short coming from 7 and 10 day races of adventure racing, but it's no less painful. I mean, I'm at 100% effort in Leadville for, 7 hours.
Well, how many watts are you pushing at Leadville? Because people don't know, it's a lot of it happens between 12 and 13,000 feet. It's burly up there, 30% less oxygen. This is literally the hardest mountain bike race in the world. Not the most technical, the hardest.
No, it's a 100 miler, but it starts at 10,000 feet. So that's your low point for the race. And it's basically a 50 mile out and back, and you're never below 10,000 feet. And so, there's very thin air. It's a very competitive race, and there's a ton of climbing. So, you're not recovering the way that you would. There's no air to breathe. And it's super, super competitive and very prestigious and very stressful. And it's a really hard event. And so I wouldn't say it's not an easy race for me. It's short in the fact that I know I'm going to have a shower that night. I'm going to have normal food to eat. And so it's really just how long can I stay right at that red line in the pain cave? And 7 hours is a long time to do that. And so
give us an example, how many watts is that? Where's your heart rate? What's your average heart rate for that piece? Just for those people who have a background, because when you do that race and you have the course record for women, it's an unbelievable aerobic achievement. Like it's mind blowing for me, actually.
I can share the file with you, but I'm trying to remember. The heart rate numbers are a little bit out the door because of the extreme altitude, and so you can't really compare it to where sea level or where you might be training. But basically, I'm at or above my threshold, heart rate threshold for 7 hours. And so, you think of your stomach is shutting down, just trying to get calories, and then the mental focus that it takes to stay, sharp for that long. And I think that's, between the people who win that race or don't, it's the people who could stay focused for that long. And any event that's over a few hours, I think that's where it gets really interesting, is where the mind starts to come in. Because everybody's hurting, everybody's trained hard, everybody's a really great athlete. And this is where my adventure racing experience and rock climbing and wall climbing experience of doing stuff for days is it honed my mental skills. And so that's what served me probably the best as an athlete this long, is that I know how to hurt and I know how to suffer, and knowing that it's going to be over in 100 miles, that's actually something I can wrap my head around. Whereas some people, 100 miles, if they've never done that, then it's really hard for them to wrap their head around. And that's why I referenced earlier is having experience and being an older athlete, you do actually, you have a leg up a little bit because you have the mental, knowledge and the strength that you can finish an event like that.
Be honest, it can always get worse. I mean, that's the thing. You always know it can hurt worse. Like it always gets worse. You guys in adventure racing were, I think, the first – that was the heyday of, like, manufactured gels and goos, and you were sponsored by Intervit at the time. But you guys had a commitment to eating food. Honey Stinger had just come out. You guys were eating sandwiches. Like I remember being blown away at some of these just like 30-hour races that you were doing that I was around, how much actual food. And we've seen, obviously, you're buddies with Alan Lim, and you're in Feed Zone Portables and all his books about that. But, seeing how much actual food you guys were consuming, and then the current revolution in performance athletics about eating food again. What do you eat during some of these races? Do you have favorites?
Yeah, I do have favorites. I mean, Alan Lim's rice cakes are awesome. You know, I'm a big fan of rice and eggs and real food if you can get it. In a race like the Leadville 100, where you really are at your, you know, aerobic threshold for a lot of time, I find it hard to eat solid foods. And so I do a lot of liquid calories. I use Goo Roctane a lot, which is their endurance formula. And what's cool about that is it basically has amino acids in it. And so instead of, there used to be this kind of fallacy that if you did endurance sports, anything over a few hours, you needed to eat protein. And really, there's a lot of amino acids in a protein, but not all of them are proven to help with endurance sports. And so what Goo did is they separated out the four or five amino acids that really do help with lactate buffering and endurance sports, and they put those back in instead of a complete protein that your body has to digest. And so, I mean, from adventure racing days, you know, as Shane can tell you, I used to eat Cheetos and gummy bears, and I basically figured that, you know, we were working so hard that I had the right to eat whatever I wanted to eat. And, you know, that was kind of my comfort food. I've since learned that, you know, if you put garbage in your mouth, you're going to get garbage out for energy. And so it's another reason I think why I've done better as I've aged is that I've learned more about nutrition, and I'm putting better things into my body now that are scientifically, you know, proven to actually help. And a lot of liquid calories really work well for me, because sometimes, I mean, your body just, all the blood is in your legs and your muscles, and you don't want to send blood to your stomach for digestion. And so it's almost like, you know, baby food or food for the elderly. It's like the simpler the digestion can be, the faster the energy delivery is to your muscles.
I could done a couple long outrigger races, and I could eat, and paddling the long days, no problem. The first time I was confronted with how difficult it was to eat, I ran the Quad Dipsy, and I ran for 8.5 hours, which, as you know, I love running, and I'm so good at it, and I was so slow, but I had a really hard time eating whole foods. That was a hard time. And then I went down the gel nightmare hole where I was just like sugar cramp, but it was partly because I was having a hard time eating. And recently, even on the Outrigger Canoe, I've been like, hey, this is gonna be like a 5 to 7 hour race. And I was trying to eat a bar and paddle and drink. And I was like, this is terrible. So it's interesting that you on the shorter races have gone towards even just, you know, liquidy, because it's just easy to drink and breathe, you know?
Yeah. There's nothing harder than opening a package while you're trying to breathe and you're like, trying to get it open. And if it's not easy, you're not going to do it. And you do need the calories. And so, calories in a bottle sometimes are easier for me than.
Are you gluten-free? Do you have anything like that? What is like, do you have any tenets about your nutrition, or like how do you eat from day to day? What's it look like?
Yeah, you know, I'm not gluten-free or any of that stuff. I sort of dabbled and tried some of those things, and they don't seem to have much effect for me. But really, the main transition with my eating has been over the years just a lot less packaged food. You know, I make a lot of food at home. I make my own bread, and just try to eat things that don't come in packages. And that's served me pretty well. And as you know, traveling, sometimes you can't be that picky. But you can always find rice and eggs almost anywhere. You can find vegetables anywhere. And so, I've just gone to a lot more whole foods and simple things. It's actually, with all the science and everything, it seems like everything has gotten simpler and simplified, you know, now than it used to be.
You have never struggled with weight. I mean, maybe early some coach said something mean to you, but you literally have always been shredded and jacked. Have you felt like you've had a hard time keeping weight on or taking weight off? You know, in cycling world, I mean, I know your body has changed radically as you need to kayak for 25 hours and do all that stuff a little bit. You look a little bit more like an endurance athlete, biker, right? Have there been things that you've, because I mean, it, even just talking to Levi recently, it is still about watt, kilopounds per watt in his head, or what, you know, grams per kilogram or whatever, kilogram watts, you know. Have you had to think about that a little bit as a modern athlete in this power game, especially since it's endurance?
Yeah, I would say, you know, contrary to what you said, that I've always sort of been concerned about weight because, I have a family genetics, that you know, I don't have the smallest family in the world, and you know, it's in my genes sort of to be bigger. And even as a rock climber, you know, all the sports I've done, I haven't been the tiniest, smallest person out there. And you know, rock climbing, you got to pull yourself up the wall, or even adventure racing, you've got to move yourself through the world. So the more weight you have, you know, power to weight ratio is always the holy grail, and cycling is no different. So I wouldn't say that it's been easy for me. It's always something that I think about. I haven't really, really struggled, but it's more the times where, you know, I gain weight in the winter. I live in a snowy environment. It gets really cold. And then in the spring, I have to shed a few pounds. But I also think that that's your body, kind of a healthy ebb and flow. I don't think it's healthy to be ultra, ultra lean all the time. It's not sustainable.
Can you tell that to my wife? She is so jacked. Let me just, for those of you, Rebecca's not going to take her shirt off and show her your abs, but let me just tell you that this woman has always made me feel bad about myself. Like, I'm all around Rebecca, and I'm like, man, I'm out of shape. I'm so fat. She's such a good dancer. Let me ask you this. You know, we talk to a lot of women who start to be perimenopausal, and not to open up a can of worms, but you know, have you noticed your physiology change as you have pushed into 40s, or have you not broached that yet and hasn't been a difference? Because Stacey Sims is a good homie of ours, and she's like, hey, look, women have real physiologically different hydration needs, recovery needs than men.
Yeah.
And are you taking that into consideration? I mean, clearly you at some point you've addressed it because you're so competent, but are you guys conscious about that?
You know, I haven't hit that stride yet in my age, so I haven't really noticed. The stuff that I have noticed with aging is I need more rest. I need to warm up better. I need to stretch more. You know, I get a little more aches and pains, and, you know, I never used to have lower back pain, and now sometimes I do, which maybe is, you know, specializing in cycling. And so I've just noticed I do have to take a little bit better recovery. Hydration and those things, you know, you can judge that really by, you know, your urine output, and those kind of things are pretty easy as long as you're paying attention to that stuff. So that I haven't had to sort of change that up, but I do have to stretch now and I have to warm up now, which is a good thing. And you use the foam roller a ton. I mean, I swear by that thing. That thing saves me.
Yeah, totally it does. Well, you are now, you know, what's the next race? Where are you going in training? Are you going to stay the best in the world just because it's convenient to be the best in the world? Like, what are you thinking in terms of your – and set the record straight. How many total world championships do you have?
Six.
Six. And that's biking, paddling, everything combined?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, combined.
So, and that's three world championships in three different sports. Is that right?
Yes.
Bam, take it, people. Like, it's so unbelievable. So, no, seriously, A, tell us what's next. What are you working on?
Let's see. Well, I need to sell that book of mine. And I will say the idea with the book wasn't to talk about myself, but the idea was to let people know that, you know, normal people can get off the couch and go do something really cool. And so the idea with the book, if somebody reads it, is hopefully that they get inspired to go have an adventure of their own. Because we all can, no matter what age you are, no matter if you have asthma or whatever your body type. So that's the idea with the book. So I'm wandering around doing book readings and signings, stuff like that. And then for me personally, my motivation is seems to be going towards adventure biking, you know, doing really long exploratory sort of things on the bicycle, like just coming back from Vietnam. And so I think that's where my head is going. You know, I've been an athlete for a long time because I've been able to kind of morph and change as my motivation changed. So right now my motivation is to maybe do some bigger, longer things, that maybe some stuff that people haven't done before.
My a couple thoughts. One is that I know you, and I read that book and I was literally like, I found out things about you I didn't know. I found out, like, you know, it was like watching your favorite movie, and it was better than you remembered. The story is—it's so incredible. It's really great. It's such a good read, and literally, I feel like I just read this other great biography by a guy named Nate Jackson, who wrote *Slow Getting Up*. He was a Bronco, and it's about his kind of time in the NFL. And really, it's not glamorous. It's not like, oh, sirens and music. And it's like, this is what it looks like to be a pro. And this is how I, you know, and it was a really great life. Like it was like, I would love my daughters to have this life. It's been such an amazing experience. And the book is really is a testament to like a life of amazing intention where you've done just incredible things. You know, it's definitely an amazing read. So, I mean, first of all, second of all, I just got a single speed again. And my first single speed, I had to put a bunch of gears on because it turned out I wasn't fit enough. And once again, the single speed has just shown me that my quads are small, my lungs are weak. Like, it's terrible. Like, I think the biking is, like, it's going to definitely be a sport that I do forever because it's so fun. So where do we find you? Where are you talking? Rebecca, where's your website? Can we follow you on Instagram? Stuff like that. Tell us.
Yeah, RebeccaRush.com. And then Instagram is Reba Rush. And Twitter is The Queen of Pain. And I do a bunch of women's clinics. And, you know, I'm all about getting more women and girls on bicycles. So I do a tour called the Gold Rush Tour with my sponsor, SRAM. So next, in a couple weeks, I'll be in California at Sea Otter. Near Monterey, doing a bunch of free women's rides for people, just get people on bikes.
Awesome. Rush, dude, it's so good to see you. And thanks for chatting to people. Dave, do we miss anything? Are you any like vital questions? Rebecca, do we something you didn't get to talk about? Do we just talk about all the old stuff, or like, what, you know, do we miss something? Here's your last minute to wrap up.
No, that was awesome. I got to get out to San Francisco and come visit your gym.
Yes, you do. And more importantly, you need to come visit the wine cellar and the hot tub. That's all you
Absolutely.
Need.
Absolutely.
All an excuse to just spend time there. That's it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Rebecca Rush, thank you so much. You're you know, as I get older and creakier, what I've noticed is that I'm a much better athlete than I was in my 20s. I'm smarter. I'm harder to beat. I'm wily. And I really feel like you've given us such a nice signpost to say, hey, look, if you do the work and are just consistent, you can really leverage these skills into just dominating these little young children, girls. And like, it's amazing. You know, I love it. I love it. So, I mean, for all of us, us athletes who are beyond the age of 22, you know, you're such an inspiration, and it's great to see you again. Thanks so much.
Oh, thanks, man. I miss you.
Miss you too. Cheers, you guys.
Thank you for listening to the MWOD Hangout, an audio project of mobilitywod.com. If you enjoyed what you heard and would like to access more content like it, check us out at mobilitywod.com. That's mobilitywod.com, where we've assembled the world's most comprehensive database of guided movement, mechanics, and mobility videos, all aiming to improve performance and eliminate pain, each motivated by a simple idea that all human beings should be able to perform basic maintenance on themselves. Cheers, you guys. Till next time.